Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I'm your host. On today's program, the perhaps dicey future of public broadcasting, as well, the FCC faces off against Senate Democrats. Should be an interesting program. You do want to stay tuned. Well, before we start today's features, I'm going to take a look at what's been going on in our media environment with some headline news. Two community radio journalists were beaten by state-supported militants in the Mexican state of Oaxaca on the night of January 24th. One was arrested. According to a report from the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, known as AMARC, the incident occurred during a confrontation between militants of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, and the Grassroots Community Council of San Antonio de Velasco in Oaxaca. Both journalists report for community radio station Radio Calenda. These acts of violence are part of an ongoing struggle between the former national ruling party PRI, which is still in power in Oaxaca, and the popular movement that believes the state's governor is illegally holding power. AMARC says that this incident is one in a series of violence perpetuated by the Mexican state, which has used excessive force to attack freedom of expression, association, and assembly, all of which have been widely documented by human rights organizations. The state-sponsored beating of these two community journalists comes after a bad year in general for journalists in Mexico, where 9 were killed in 2006, according to Reporters Without Borders. A significant portion of the violence against reporters happened in Oaxaca. The ongoing popular resistance in that Mexican state is the subject of a new book by Nancy Davies, who appeared twice last year on this program. The book is titled The People Decide, Oaxaca's Popular Assembly, and is being released by the publishing arm of Narconews.com. The book brings together 9 months of Davies' regular reports from Oaxaca, where she lives, and is compiled by George Salzman, who also appeared with Davies on Media Geek, and radical social philosopher James Herod, a member of the Lucy Parsons Center Collective. The book includes an extensive introduction by Salzman, based on his own eyewitness experience in Oaxaca, along with a special update from Davies, appearing for the first time in print. Narco News is a very grassroots organization that has been able to find the funds for an initial press run of 1,000 copies. In order to fund a larger printing, Narco News is asking interested readers to reserve their copies in advance. You can find out more at narconews.com. A bill that would undo some of the more odious portions of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is due to be introduced before the end of the month by Virginia Representative Rick Boucher. This bill, which failed in previous sessions of Congress, is supported by the Consumer Electronics Association, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Public Knowledge. If passed, Boucher's bill would end the ban against using circumventing anti-pirates would be, I'm sorry, let me try this again. If passed, Boucher's bill would end the ban against circumventing anti-piracy technologies for purposes that don't otherwise break copyright law. At present time, it is illegal to break anti-piracy tech, like the encoding on commercial DVD movies, in order to make a backup copy of the movie or to extract a clip for use in a way that is legal under fair use provisions. Boucher's bill, which is not quite finished, aims to restore to people the ability and right to circumvent such encryption to make legal uses of copyright material. Predictably, both the movie and recording industry lobbies oppose the bill, and given that Hollywood is represented by many Democrats in Congress, there may be some bipartisan opposition in Congress too. A little bit more of what the new Democratic Congress is going to do about the internet has become clearer. On February 2nd, Massachusetts Representative Edward Markey, the new chairman of the House Subcommittee on Telecommunications and the Internet, delivered the keynote address at Consumer Federation of America's Consumer Assembly in Washington, D.C. In it, Markey outlined his committee's telecommunications agenda for this session of Congress. He emphasized making broadband internet service ubiquitous and affordable and ensuring network neutrality with what he called, quote, an open architecture that supports internet freedom, end quote. Fellow Democrat Representative Rick Boucher delivered a similar but perhaps more industry-friendly message earlier the same week. Speaking at the third annual State of the Internet Conference, he told the conference, quote, "The internet must remain open and accessible to all, but we won't want to hobble innovation within the network," end quote. That's a bit of what's going on in our media environment, and you are listening to Media Geek. Check it out online, www.mediageek.net, for the Media Geek blog, lots of news and views I don't quite have time for here on the program. In fact, it's older than the radio program. It goes back about 7 years now. You can also check out the radio show online at radio.mediageek.net, where I'm getting ready to celebrate the 5th anniversary of this program. Hey, you can subscribe to the podcast too, which isn't quite 5 years old, because podcasting as such isn't quite 5 years old. All at mediageek.net. If you have any comments about the program, I'd love to hear them. Paul@mediageek.net. And so public broadcasting, it's been with us, well, all the way since the late 1960s. And for many, it's a very important part of their media life, but it's often threatened, it's often under fire, and often criticized for really not keeping up with the needs of the public and for becoming over-commercialized while that happened. At the National Conference for Media Reform that happened back at the beginning of January, there was a panel taking on what is the future of public broadcasting. And I'd like to play comments from two of the panelists who I thought had some interesting things to say about public broadcasting. First, we'll hear from Peter Hart, who comes from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. You might have heard of FAIR because they produce a newsletter called Extra, and they are very, very keen media watchdogs. They also produce the weekly community radio program called Counterspin. And then we'll hear from Leslie Fields Cruz, who comes from the National Black Programming Coalition. First, let's hear from Peter Hart.
I'm going to talk about the fight against public broadcasting, the fight against PBS, and what those of us in this broad media reform movement should be doing about it. FAIR has taken a position that's a little outside the consensus in the media reform movement, and we're hoping to push this line as much as we can. The fight over public broadcasting is, if anything, a pretty familiar one. Happens the same way every time. They're right-wing pundits or politicians, whether they be talk show hosts or Newt Gingrich, scream about liberal bias, and they call for defunding the system, pull out all the federal money. Activists and advocates for public broadcasting rally around Save Big Bird, Save Sesame Street, and the like. A very long process ensues. A leaner Corporation for Public Broadcasting budget survives this fight. The right has chipped away at public broadcasting. Management at public broadcasting will often express interest in accommodating these bogus right-wing concerns. We have stories of this over the years. Talks with Newt Gingrich about developing his own program, so then public broadcasting won't be so biased. And then we repeat the whole thing about 2 or 4 years later, depending on the election cycle and so forth. The funny thing about this is that to hear some in the media reform movement tell it, that's a victory, that when we win that slightly leaner CPB budget, we've done something good. We've saved PBS. The reform groups, many of them are here this weekend, will summon their members to quote-unquote save PBS. It survives, and that's good news. At FAIR, we've been asking most recently a different kind of question, and it starts from a simple one. What is public broadcasting supposed to do? The CPB, which is a funding arm of public broadcasting, says that what they're supposed to do is encourage programs that address the needs of unserved and underserved audiences, particularly children and minorities. PBS, according to the 1967 Carnegie Commission report, is to provide a voice for groups in the community that may otherwise be unheard, to serve as a forum for controversy and debate, and to broadcast programs that help us see America whole in all its diversity. All of that sounds fantastic. The question you have to ask yourself is public broadcasting, particularly the national programming on NPR and PBS, fulfilling that mandate? And when we study that at FAIR, and we've been doing this for 20 years, the answer is usually some variation of No. The guest list of NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, our most recent survey showed, skewed very white male and Republican. Doesn't differ with the old research on this. And I think the main lesson from any of the research we've done, I have copies of the magazine if you'd like to get one later, shows that public broadcasting often replicates what's in the commercial media already. So if you watch Washington Week in Review, you can watch a panel that consists of three or four mainstream journalists who you've been able to read or see in other venues throughout the week. Not that it's a bad show necessarily, but it doesn't offer anything that I think would fulfill PBS's mandate. The NewsHour, Charlie Rose, McLaughlin Group, these national NPR shows, these are not forums most often for diverse dissenting views. Now, the program, I think, is a great counterexample. And a great counterexample because we can see what played out when the show really hit its stride. What happened was exactly what you'd expect would happen. Right-wing groups were furious that such a thing was even on television. They demanded that conservative shows be added to balance the dangerous content that was airing every Friday night. I talked to a right-wing talk show host at a media event, and he was telling me, obviously, PBS is biased way to the left. They've got Bill Moyers on every night. I said, that's a weekly show. That's on once a week. And he said, well, it seems like it's every night to me. That's the level of criticism that you have of public broadcasting. And it's our job, apparently, to try to debunk that kind of thing by showing them a schedule for his television channel. The right wing thundered away about Now. The funding debate got hot, even though it didn't really relate to what Now was doing. All of this because a show on public broadcasting decided to do what public broadcasting is supposed to do. Now, as activists, we have to think, what does this long history and this more recent history tell us we should be doing? On our side, for years, the demand has been to merely keep the thing alive without making any demands about what kind of programming we'd like to see, what kind of changes we think would benefit our communities locally and nationally. What about the right wing? They've demanded programming over the years, and they've got it. Firing Line, the McLaughlin Group, Think Tank, there have been shows hosted by Laura Ingraham, Fred Barnes, Bill Bennett, on and on. And you've seen these censorious campaigns. A children's show that included a lesbian couple is censored a couple years ago, one of the more pathetic and disgraceful capitulations in recent memory. So knowing all that, what do we do? Is that the system we just want to keep alive? It seems to us that the answer is to think about how to restructure the funding mechanism, the CPB. Get rid of this, which is basically a political patronage system, and explore different models for funding this. Some of these have been discussed for years. A lot of other countries, particularly in Europe, have these alternative models. They create an independent trust that keeps the money out of the hands of politicians. Bob Dole, Newt Gingrich, and the like don't like what they see on public broadcasting. There's nothing they can do about it. Would that be easy? Probably not. But the irony of this is that the CPB was created to shield public broadcasters from political interference. In reality, what's happened is the opposite. They've encouraged exactly that kind of interference from politicians directly into programming. The long lesson here, I think, is that activists who enjoy what they enjoy about public broadcasting, and there often is quite a bit to enjoy, we should be encouraged to ask for more of it, not simply ask that that station stay on the air, the status quo be maintained. Otherwise, the cries to save PBS will begin to sound absurd. We'll be asking this growing media movement to help save institutions that are offering less and less of what they're supposed to be doing in the first place. So that's our challenge, I think, as media reformers and media activists, to find a way to say we're not going to have this debate every 2 years about whether PBS is liberal or NPR is a socialist enterprise. We're going to find a way to promote an alternative vision of funding truly independent public broadcasting. Thanks.
Your materials will say we're about to hear from Jackie Jones of the National Black Programming Consortium. I'm told that Jackie's out of the country and couldn't actually get back and join us. She has her regrets. But from the National Black Programming Consortium, we have Leslie Fields Cruz, who's the director of programming there. Leslie.
Okay, I found out I was coming on Sunday. I got exactly the idea of what I'm going to be talking about Monday or Tuesday. I am, and I got here this morning. So I think that after looking at why I'm here, I figure I'm really to talk about that issue of diversity. The National Black Programming Consortium, we've been around for 26 years. We fund programs that end up on public television. We fund specifically programs that speak to the African-American and African diaspora experience. We are part of five minority consortia. There's the Pacific Islanders in Communication. There's the Center for Asian American Media. There's the Native American Public Telecommunications. And let's see, there's five. Oh, Latino Public Broadcasting. Each of us with the mission to support programming about our communities for public television, as well as to do outreach and connect to our communities and bring them into public television. Now, I just would like everybody to take a really good look around the room. How diverse is it? Okay. How diverse is it in age? Okay. Yeah. Okay. When I came to NBPC, it was run under a woman named Mabel Haddock. Mabel Haddock was the founding director at NBPC. Fierce. Fierce woman. She was about this tall. And I remember her on the phone fussing with a programmer about the placement of Stanley Nelson's A Place of Our Own. A Place of Our Own was about Martha's Vineyard and the black community at Martha's Vineyard, and also a personal story about Stanley and his father and their relationship. The programmer was adamant about making sure it aired during Black History Month. And Mabel said, "You know what? I can see you need some programming for Black History Month, but this really isn't a Black History Month program. It actually, you can put it on at any time, perhaps in the summer, since it has to do with, you know, a vacation spot." But they put it on in Black History Month, and she argued and she fought for it, but she couldn't really get around some of those structures that we have to deal with at public television. But I learned a very valuable lesson from this, that my job is to make sure that I fight for the best placement of our programs, that I make sure that I'm continually bringing in work that's going to challenge them, to challenge the programmers to place it not just during Black History Month, because Black history or Black experience is everybody's experience, and it should be on at any point in time. And I think it's the same challenge that all of the consortia that we have. We want to make sure that our programs aren't ghettoized in a specific heritage month. Because, and then outside of all, from that, when you start diversifying your programming, your schedule, you'll start bringing in a more diverse audience that also potentially might bring in more membership dollars. I agree that I think that the system needs to be reexamined. I'm not certain that how we're funding public television is the best way. But I also think that with the new media and the digital environment that we're in, there is a way that we can attract audiences and diverse audiences that run, you know, diverse either ethnically, generationally, or economically to public television, and that the internet and the new media platforms can really, truly speak to the idea of a public dialogue, a public media. I think that's pretty much what I want to say right now. Thank you.
And that was Leslie Fields Cruz, who is from the National Black Programming Coalition. Before that, we heard from Peter Hart with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. and they were both speaking at a session entitled based on the future of public broadcasting, both calling certain elements into doubt. More Peter Hart did that more so than Ms. Fields Cruz, but definitely noted things that do need some change in public broadcasting, and that happened at the National Conference for Media Reform number 3, which happened on January 13th. That panel happened on January 13th, 2007 in Memphis, Tennessee. That's about the end of the National Conference for Media Reform audio that I'll be bringing you here on Media Geek, but almost all of it is archived online. If you're interested in hearing some more, you can go on over to freepress.net. And you are listening to Media Geek. Next up, we're going to look over to Congress. On February 1st, as I previewed last week, the FCC, the commissioners, sat in front of the Senate Commerce Committee, which is now run by Democrats. And the Democrats kind of stuck it to, especially FCC Chairman Kevin Martin, who was questioned by Senate Commerce Committee Chairman Daniel Inouye, concerned about comments that Chairman Martin made about network neutrality provisions put into the AT&T and Bell South merger. But someone who really went in for the kill was Senator Barbara Boxer of California, who took direct aim at Chairman Martin regarding a report that her office uncovered about local media ownership that the FCC apparently had buried. Let's hear more from that confrontation.
And I want to talk to you, Chairman Martin, and then ask others. It was only 4 months ago that you sat before the committee during your confirmation hearing, although it seems like longer somehow. As I'm sure you remember, I presented you with a copy of a news media localism study prepared by the FCC staff at taxpayer expense that was shoved in a drawer because its conclusions apparently ran counter to some interests who want to allow more media consolidation and who believe that such consolidation leads to more and not less local news, or at least that's what they say. I was further troubled when I learned of the suppression of a second FCC study, this one related to radio station, only days later. You and I talked about it publicly, privately, and as a result of this, I, along with Senators Dorgan and Wyden, call for the Inspector General to investigate the suppression of these studies, and I'm anxiously awaiting this report that's due in the spring. Now, I'd hoped that the revelation of these suppressed studies would have led to greater transparency and openness at the FCC. Unfortunately, published news reports and even comments by some of the commissioners here today indicate that a culture of secrecy is still pervasive at the FCC. It is sadly ironic that an agency dedicated to promoting free and open communications would operate in the dark. For example, the Associated Press recently published a story about the investigation of the suppressed media ownership studies. According to the AP report, the Inspector General has not interviewed two key witnesses, and I trust he will do so before he completes his report, and I really think this is important. Also, it's reported that during a Bar Association dinner recently, Chairman Martin, you joked that the KGB-like atmosphere of the FCC grows on the staff. This is your words, the KGB-like atmosphere. Now, I do believe many times truth is often said in jest. So, Chairman Martin, for the sake of the staff and the public, I hope we're going to see some changes that are long overdue. Now, Chairman Martin, I know you can't comment on the ongoing Inspector General investigation. But when these two reports came to light, you told me, and I quote, "I want to assure you that I too am concerned about what happened to these two draft reports." So I'm asking you, after learning of the suppressed studies, did you perform your own internal investigation to determine why these studies were not disclosed, why they were shoved in the drawer? Who shoved them in the drawer? Did you do anything internally?
Yes.
What did you do?
Well, first, I just wanted to clarify one thing you said. I said recently the statement about the KGB-like atmosphere. That was actually over 18 months ago. But I did joke about that at the FCPA dinner.
Well, let it stand that you did say that, the KGB-like atmosphere. And everybody knows what the KGB-like atmosphere is, if we want to go into it, you know.
I did at the FCC.
It's kind of a sick thing to say, but that's your choice of joke.
No, it was in jest and talking about the complaints about the fact that I have been too actually hands-on and controlling of the commission's policies versus the staff. But I don't think it was meant in terms of the suppressing a study. And the reason I wanted to clarify when is because it was done prior to any of the issues that you raised.
I know, but it gets to an atmosphere. An atmosphere over there. I'm trying to get to that. But if you could just tell me, what exactly did you do?
Oh, no, sure.
After we spoke and you said, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. What have you done? Because I haven't heard of anything that you've done.
I'm sorry. Well, the very first thing that we did is, and I promised you that I would make sure that I uncovered any other studies that anybody had claimed they had done that had not been released to the public. So I had every bureau chief in the agency go forward and say to all of the staff members who had worked on anything related to media ownership or localism to provide copies of anything they had done that they thought was a study that had not been provided. We then made copies of all of that. I shared that with all of the commissioners. Our general counsel's office had gone through them and identified that there were a few that were emails that weren't even studies. And we provided copies of all of those to Congress, to the committees, okay, including the ones that the general counsel's office didn't want to be released to the public because they were emails. And then we released all of that to the public and put it
up. Well,
I
have one more question, Mr. Chairman. My time is up, but I want to follow up. It's my understanding that, in fact, you did look back, that the FCC has withheld 1,400 pages. Why have these pages been withheld? And I would like to ask, if after you answer, Commissioner Edelstein and Copps to respond. Yeah.
In relation to the request that I made, that after your inquiry at my confirmation hearing, that everything anybody had ever done in relation to any studies that had been produced related to media ownership or any concerns they had to provide them, we've provided all of them to Congress already. There was a separate FOIA request,
right,
that was made by some outside groups that asked for things that were much beyond the other studies, including any information, anything that the commission had on ownership, which would involve emails, documents, draft documents that had been produced. And that was handled by the general counsel's office, as all FOIAs are.
All right, and that was Senator Boxer, Barbara Boxer of California, putting the screws to FCC Chairman Kevin Martin. On February 1st, during an FCC visit, a somewhat contentious visit to the Senate Commerce Committee. Afterwards, both Commissioners Copps and Adelstein, the two Democrats in the commission, expressed that they don't really know much of what is actually going on, but do support openness. It's mostly in the field of the chairman to take care of those things. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can be downloaded at radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. The program is also heard on 10 other community stations around North America. They are Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington, and Free Radio San Diego. Media Geek is free to air on your local community station as well. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also the address where you can send your comments about the program. Once again, that's Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.